Welcome to Ask the Chief Information Officer on Federal News Radio. Every week, Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller interviews CIOs of federal agencies about the latest directives, IT challenges, and successes. Now, your host, Jason Miller.
My guest today is Andy Wasser, the Associate Dean in Carnegie Mellon University's Hine College School of Information Systems and Management and the Executive Director of the CIO Institute. Andy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jason. Thanks. Glad to be a part of it.
So it's been about 4 years since I caught up with someone from Carnegie Mellon about their CIO program. So there's a lot to catch up. 4 years is a long time in the IT world. So let's just start with some basics. Talk about the program. What's it focused on? How does it work? Give us the 50,000-foot view.
Sure. Well, we run the program out of Arlington, Virginia, by the Ballston Station in our Software Engineering Institute. We do that out of the convenience for all the federal sector workers, as well as for anybody traveling from afar. It's easier to get in through the multiple airports in the district. We run it as a face-to-face program, and that's really key. It's set up as 8 3-day modules. So there'll be 3 days in September, October, November. We try to avoid the holidays in the summer. And we do it face-to-face, whereas most of our other programs have a combination of distance and face-to-face or pure distance. And we do that because we find that for people who are at senior positions in IT, they really are craving the opportunity to interact with each other as much as they are with the faculty at Carnegie Mellon University and hear their shared pains and ideas. And so we haven't been able to find a way to totally replicate that model in a distance format.
And now you said 8 3-day modules, so it's one 3-day grouping per month for 8 months. Is that the way it works?
That's right. We do each one once a year, and so we'll have one, for example, on information resiliency and assurance, one on enterprise architecture that I actually teach in, one on leadership and communication skills. Each one has a different theme, but we have different instructors for each day.
And talk about a little bit about how the instructors work. Are they federal officials? Are they academics? Are they a mixture?
It's really a combination. So we have the tenured faculty who are world-renowned in their field, and they're teaching a number of the classes. Someone like David Crackhart is one of the world's foremost leaders in organizational behavior, so he teaches that section. Then we have some faculty who are top practitioners in but not on the research side, someone like an Ari Lightman, who's an expert on social media. And then we have some top government workers, someone like an Al Dupree, who's the chief innovation officer at NIST, teaching a module. So it truly is a combination. We try not to be too religious about it. We try to just get the best instructor for the topic that we're trying to cover.
And give me a sense about how the courses work. It's a 8 3-day modules. At the end, are you writing papers? Are there tests? Is it a group project? And then what's the outcome? You get a certificate or a master's or what?
It's set up as executive education. And so the good news about that is that it's not the papers, it's not the tests, it's not the assessments. And the bad news about it is that it's not the papers, it's not the tests, it's not the assessments. So it's really what you get into it. If you are really engaged with the instructor and with the group, there's case studies, there's exercises, there's lectures, but highly interactive lectures. But it is not set up like a master's degree. And we have some wonderful master's degrees that we provide, but this is more, you know, if there's a module that interests you, you can be at the edge of your seat listening and engaging with the instructor, and if it doesn't, you can, you know, be thinking about, you know, other things going on in your life. What we do is that all the money that you would put into this program in terms of fees if you decide to then go into our master's program, and we get a number of participants who get the itch after the taking these classes, we applied every single dollar towards your master's degree. So we reduced the master's degree by the amount of the certificate.
So at the end, you get this CIO certificate that you've passed the program, you've taken these courses, you've gotten these skills, and that seems to be very popular. So give me a sense of how many federal employees, how many government contractors are, you know, taking part of the program each year, or at least if you have some other statistics, life of the program.
We try to keep the room size very small, between 16 and 20 people in the room. And there used to be a federally recognized certificate, but for whatever reason, the GSA decided to do away with that. And so now it's just a university certificate. What I really like about it being just a university certificate is that there were things that had to be done when it was a federal certificate that followed the old Clinger-Cohen Act. And the Clinger-Cohen Act was a great act, and technology has moved on a little bit since then. And so it's given us the freedom to really evolve the program with maximum flexibility. Of the 16 to 20 people in the room, we're about split half and half between the federal sector and state sector and the private industry. We have participants from the FBI, Homeland Security, the Mint, Department of State, the Post Office, but we've also had the Department of Transportation in Wyoming, and then people from IT leaders from banks and hospitals and private other manufacturing type companies. And what I think is the most exciting part of it is the fact that someone will say, well, in healthcare we do it this way. And someone else will say, well, but in the oil and gas industry we have faced this challenge. And someone else will say, hey, I work in the State Department, and here's what we do. And that bouncing back and forth between across different industries and domains is pretty telling.
So it's interesting that, you know, you keep it small, which is good because it's better for learning. And then, but two is you do have this wide variety of people because they do, as you said, the interaction piece is so important that if it was all distance learning, they wouldn't be able to create those relationships. They wouldn't be able to create that community of interest and in where then they could lean on each other. Do you find that's what happens, is once they create this relationship with these 16 to 20 people, it continues along, you know, maybe not in a formal way, but the guy from the hospital calls up the woman from the bank and asks, hey, I'm having this problem. Do you have any solutions? Do you find that continues on?
Yeah, exactly. And it's mostly anecdotal, and it depends on how sort of interested you are in networking. But we try to create the environment. We have a lot say, hey, it's Monday night, let's meet up for some drinks. We create some electronic community for them to interact, but it really depends on you and whether you like, you know, whether you've met somebody or a group of people that you'd like to engage in. One of the areas that we learned from doing the CIO Institute is a lot of the IT leadership, particularly in the government, but the private sector as well, came to us after our information assurance module and said, we need more. There's just too much going on in this domain right now for us to be able to cover this in a 3-day module. And so out of the CIO Institute, we created a program called CISO for Chief Information Security Officers, and we now deliver that twice a year. And that's a combination hybrid program where they meet in Pittsburgh on our main campus at the beginning and at the end. At the end, there's a major practicum that they engage in. But everything else is via synchronous distance learning. And we've been really pleased that they get to bond enough in the few days that they're with each other live that carries through to the distance learning, and that the discussion threads and the communications are fairly vibrant in that environment.
Sounds like you were just saying earlier, maybe there's a model there that maybe you could apply to the CIOs as well.
Yeah, yes and no. So I think why it works for them is that they're all under siege with everything that's going on with risk management and cybersecurity. And so there's such a talent shortage in that particular area that they do seem to have a real common interest. Whereas with the CIO Institute, it might be very spread in terms of what your role in the organization is, running something, and what somebody else's is. So a little less commonality.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Before we do that, tell us real quick the prices per class or for the entire CIO certificate program, and real quick, the CISO program as well. How much do those cost?
The CIO program is it's $29.50 for each three-day module, but I think more applicable to the government employees and the people in the armed services, it's $2,500. Which would make the three-day program a $20,000 cost. Likewise, the CISO is discounted for government employees, and that six-month program is at a $15,000 cost for government employees.
All right, very good. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about how the programs have changed over time. You give us a little bit of a heads-up when it came to cybersecurity. But first, my guest today is Andy Wasser, the Associate Dean in Carnegie Mellon University's Hines College School of Information Systems and Management, and the Executive Director of the CIO Institute. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. We have a special edition of Ask the CIO today. My guest is Andy Wasser, the Executive Director of the CIO Institute at Carnegie Mellon University. Andy, before break, we're talking about the program, how it works, some of the classes, the learning atmosphere. Let's talk about some of the coursework, and the fact is, how has the CIO certificate program evolved over the last few years? There's so many changes in technology. I just spoke to you guys about 4 years ago, and I'm sure the programs are much different today than they were just 4 years ago. Talk about that evolution.
Some things have changed incredibly over the 15 years that we've been running this program. There's sensors on every device and on every bridge. There's agile practices that didn't exist before. The data analytics and data science practices, and just the sheer enormity of the structured and unstructured data. Obviously, mobile and cloud, and all of the social media has changed. And so in that respect, that is embedded throughout all of our classes. But the more interesting thing to me is that the thing that hasn't changed is that human beings haven't changed. We're still resistant to change. It's hard, difficult to build consensus. You're still dealing with difficult people. There's still talent shortages. So some of the organizational issues you have with running an operation in terms of communicating your message, communicating a complex set of topics, discussing risk, those things seem to transcend time. They seem to stay the same. So trying to get those core human topics and just now how do they apply to the new world that we find ourselves in.
And I think that's so interesting because so many times when I talk to other CIOs in the government and they say, well, the technology is not the problem, it's the culture. And if I had a nickel for every right. time I heard it's the culture problem, I could retire already. So why is the culture so hard, and how do you guys address that culture issue? Because you probably know it's the most difficult thing.
It's funny, when I started my career in the in IT in the late 80s, there was a survey done of CIOs, CFOs, COOs, and they said, you know, what's the biggest challenge in technology? And what came out across the board was aligning people, processes, and technology, that was the biggest challenge, what we'd call enterprise architecture. And I came across a study last year where they talked to, again, the same C-suite and asked them the same question and got the exact same answer. It still seems to be aligning people, processes, and technologies. And what's scary now, and I think what scares a lot of CIOs, is just the speed of technology change. You know, the government has found some ways to operate quicker, but technology is just moving at such a pace that, you know, the idea of with the fixed budgets and with the same people challenges to keep up with Silicon Valley has proven, I think that's what keeps the CIOs up at night.
And it's funny because that's the other piece of it is how do you ensure that you're keeping up with the technology so you're not impacting the business side so they don't just go off on their own and do what they want to do. The old joke, don't be the CIO of no, where that's a part of the relationship building. Are there a couple courses that you guys have and that really focus? You mentioned one, communication and skills. Are there some other ones similar to that you guys have that addresses this people culture issue?
Yeah, yes, there are. And, you know, it's funny, you talked about, I don't know if the term closet IT has come up in your other discussions, but the idea that now it's so easy for people to just say, hey, I'll call Amazon Web Services on my own. I don't need you. I can get around you. And to what extent do you want to allow your teams to do an end around and do the closet IT type work? So we have a few areas where we go into this in a big way. One is in terms of that enterprise architecture module, and another is in terms of strategy and communication. And we have some wonderful faculty that really talk about informal information networks and what we can do to sort of execute strategy on the ground. And what's unique about Carnegie Mellon is that it's not an ivory tower. We came from blue-collar roots in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, with Andrew Carnegie, who helped build the steel industry. And we still very much have those down-to-earth, blue-collar, applied practices. And we try to not focus too much on theory and more focus on practice.
And I think the idea, you called it closet IT, we call it shadow IT. That's just another name for it that's come up. And that's a huge issue because you're right. I mean, it's so easy to go to one of the big box stores, buy some software, put it on your system and go with it without any security or other pieces of that. Talk a little bit about the changes in the classes that you've seen. You talked about sensors on devices, so Internet of Things. You talked about Agile. We've heard Agile before. It's called modular contracting, but it's gotten a new kind of life. Cloud, data analytics, mobility. What are some of the newest classes, you know, maybe that you guys have brought in over the last year or two?
One thing that's interesting is that people hear about all these things going on in data analytics and cybersecurity and agile. And whenever they come and talk to us, they'll always start out by apologizing, by saying, oh, you know, I work for a pharmaceutical company, or I work for the government, or I work for the hospital, or I work for the bank, and we are way behind on all these areas. And everyone thinks they're behind because I think they're reading and watching the media and think that everybody's doing all this incredibly cool stuff with predictive analytics and with these modular systems that, without any human intervention, and everything's perfect. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, you're not behind. Everybody's feeling that same pressure. And so just acknowledging that and going into recognizing that there's opportunities. We have a faculty member, Norman Sadeh, who talks about mobile and pervasive computing, really the trends in mobile, how to keep things secure, how to control, a mobile environment without losing the security and losing the practices. We have topics on that we've introduced on just communicating complexity, which we when we speak to CISOs and CIOs, one of the key things they tell us is that they have difficulty communicating to their senior management, to their suppliers, to their customers, the threats, the opportunities, and the challenges that they're facing. And you think that the problems that they're facing would be technology stuff like Hadoop and MapReduce and all the intense areas of technology, but it's not. It's simply in the communication side.
I know it's so simple in terms of recognizing the problem and talking about what my problem is, but the solutions are not always readily available or easily done because, again, as you talked about earlier, it's a people issue. It's a people challenge, not necessarily a technology challenge.
Yeah, and Jason, one of the things that happens is that IT people tend to come from a more engineering perspective, and if they have 12 things to say to you, they want to say all 12. They don't recognize that the people they're talking to may want to just hear the top three. And maybe if you could really get them engaged in the top three, you can discuss the next two. But you're never going to go through the laundry list. And so part of it is just understanding your audience, how to communicate in their terms, and how to do so with a end in sight. You know, what is the purpose of this communication? What am I trying to get through and then end up with at the end of the day?
We hear the same thing about the contracting officers and contracting representatives talk business acumen. I think CIOs need the same thing. So I think your point's good. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll jump into a study that you guys did with PricewaterhouseCooper, and then we'll talk a little bit about what you found there. My guest is Andy Wasser, the Executive Director of the CIO Institute at the Carnegie Mellon University. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest is Andy Wasser, the Executive Director of the CIO Institute at the Carnegie Mellon University. Now, Andy, before break, we talked a lot about the courses and the classes you guys offer. You guys also did a study with PricewaterhouseCooper of federal CIOs, and I thought this study was fascinating in several ways. Start off by telling us a little bit about the survey, why you guys did it, how it worked, who you talked to, and then we'll discuss the findings.
We really wanted to get a better understanding of what was in the head of the office of the CIO, where they felt challenged, what their opportunities were, and partnering with Pricewaterhouse was a terrific idea because they have their set of clients, we have our set of stakeholders, and what's nice about Carnegie Mellon University and any university is that we're sort of Switzerland. We're neutral. We don't have a bias in terms of vendors and the like, and so we're able to look at things with a fairly objective and open perspective.
So you talk to federal CIOs, how many, from which agencies generally do across the board?
20 agencies, and it would be all the agencies that you'd expect, and it was a few hundred people, some detailed interviews as well as surveys. The thing that's interesting today, Jason, is that we used to think in terms of the IT department, and there's no longer the IT department. IT is embedded in every single operation that we have, and so in some ways we're all the IT department. There's talking some areas where you'd say we're talking to chief risk officers at one at Under Armour, one at a cosmetics company, and you say, what are the IT issues at a clothing company or a cosmetics company? And then they start going into their challenges, and you say, wow, I didn't realize how much technology is infused in pretty much every single thing we do today.
When you talk about it, I mean, that's one of the reasons you brought up Clinger Cohen earlier, and there's the new Federal IT Acquisition Reform Act, FITARA, is really trying to hone in on that issue, that IT is no longer just in the realm of the CIO, but the chief financial officer, the chief acquisition officer, the chief human capital officer, and so on and so forth, have to know and understand and work closely with the CIO. The survey, several interesting findings. Talk about the ones that really stood out to you.
There's still a lot of proprietary systems out there. And with things being lean and mean, both in the private sector and in the public sector, about 80% of what we do is just operating what we have. And so it leaves very little room for us to innovate, introduce new technologies, keep up with all the trends of what are going on in technology in the society. And so the clear challenge to the Office of the CIOs in the federal sector is to find a way to minimize that 80%, to take parts of that and just squeeze it down or eliminate it altogether so that you free up the resources you need to get to all the new cool stuff that's out there. Because if all you're doing is keeping the trains on the track and doing the day-to-day, you're never going to be able to move forward.
And I think that's a huge push from the Office of Management and Budget today. They talk about, in the government terms, O&M versus DME, operations and maintenance and development modernization enhancement. And I think that is something that is being focused upon, because how do you move to the cloud? How do you bring in agile processes and innovations if you don't have the money for it? Because there's always that upfront investment. Did you find that CIOs, when you talk to them through the survey, are they looking for ways to do that, or do they feel like they're stuck in a rut?
No, I think they're absolutely looking for ways. There are a few that are just so frustrated by the bureaucracies and the culture holding them back. But the majority of them are doing things. So you mentioned the cloud, and I don't know if you're familiar with FedRAMP, which is a fabulous thing that the GSA, NIST, Homeland Security, DOD, the Office of Management Budget have all gotten together to say, hey, when we go to the cloud, let's have some consistency, reusability, uniformity. We can accelerate all the security and all the operational issues of going to either a private or a public cloud by having a standard set of practices. And I think it's been enormously successful, and it has freed up so much of the people and time and budget of the IT departments so that they can focus on other things than running a data center.
Yes, FedRAMP, we are quite familiar with, one of our most favored covered areas of the cloud in IT, because
okay. It
has a lot of people going on. Anything surprise you from these results from the survey you did with PricewaterhouseCooper?
Maybe not surprising, but one of the things that people are focused more on resiliency than anything else at this point. The idea of if, and I hope this is timely, there's a snowstorm in the district, how are you going to keep your operations going? And if, God forbid, there's a terrorist act or a cyber attack, what are you going to do to make sure that core government services and systems are up and working? And so I think that was an area that was important. And the other was just trying to get away from the proprietary systems and moving to a more virtual environment, moving the commodity services to standardized enterprise software platforms.
And I think that's a couple of the key initiatives coming from OMB as well, the move to the virtual environment, commodity services, you know, whether you move into an enterprise shared service or just do it in a way that's more effective and more efficient. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we can talk about some of the other findings of the survey you guys did. My guest today is Andy Wasser, the Executive Director of the CIO Institute at the Carnegie Mellon University. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I am your host, Jason Miller, and my guest today is Andy Wasser, the executive director of the CIO Institute at the Carnegie Mellon University. Now, Andy, we were talking about the survey you guys did with PricewaterhouseCoopers with federal CIOs and others. One of the interesting findings was from the survey was about workforce challenges. Discuss what the CIOs told you guys.
We always hear about the unemployed, but we also hear the other side, that there's an incredible talent shortage, and we're all facing many open positions that we can't fill. And the challenges of attracting and retaining employees who have the technical skills seems to be something that goes across every sector that we see. And for government employees, it's particularly tough because oftentimes you're limited to bringing in employees who are U.S. citizens and bringing in employees who can have higher level security clearances, and also bringing in employees who might have options for higher paid jobs with bonuses and stock options in the private sector. And so trying to create an environment where you can attract and retain this talent pool is something that is paramount in today's environment.
And I know that the Office of Personnel Management recently allowed agencies to increase the cap levels they can give for retention, relocation, you know, recruitment bonuses. I know there's OPM also is working to bring in more people so they can get their master's degrees. Why is this talent gap so difficult for the government? You went through a couple different reasons, but do the CIOs or the people, when you bring people into the classes, do they talk about the impact it's having on their agencies?
Absolutely. They're saying that projects are being delayed, projects are not being launched. Opportunities that a private sector might have to engage with an offshore outsourcing partner aren't really open to the federal sector. And so you spoke, Jason, about salaries and compensation. The one thing that we're hearing is that as important or maybe more important is creating a sense of purpose. Having team know that you're doing this towards a societal impact and goal that's meaningful. And when we find that organizations, and I know the FBI is working really hard to do this with their talent acquisition, when they can do that, then you get the benefits in terms of the attracting the talent, but more importantly, retaining the talent. Because it's not like in years past where someone would get a job at the bank or Procter & Gamble or at a federal agency and stay there for 25, 30 years. Oftentimes, they're looking at a 2-3-4 year window in terms of staying with a specific organization.
And I think that's probably one of the biggest changes that the CIO community has to get used to, is that they're not going to get somebody and they'll stay for 20, 30, 40 years. They will leave in 5 years, but they may come back in 5 years after that.
Right.
And I think that's...
Especially if you create the environment that attracts them back.
Do you guys talk about how to create that environment? Because, I mean, obviously...
Absolutely. That's a major emphasis of what we talk of, creating sort of a culture and where people can see that they enjoy coming into work every day, they see value in what they're doing, they think that their voice and ideas are heard. I spoke to a senior FBI agent, and he said that When he came in, it was assumed for the first 5 years as a junior agent, you would just shut up and listen. We can't do that with young talent anymore. They're not of that mindset. They want to be heard. They want to be engaged. They want to have an impact.
The other issue that I hear oftentimes is they can get people maybe at the lower level, I mean, junior people, and then get people maybe at the highest level. So people want to be a CIO of HHS or VA or wherever. But it's that middle management piece, the 40-year-old to 55-year-old who may be making decent money in the government but could do a lot better in the private sector. That's the hardest area to fill. Do you hear the same thing?
We hear that there's problems at the junior level and the mid-level. And part of the issue is just a STEM challenge across the board in the United States in terms of not enough of our college-age people are coming into these fields. And part of it is the fact that the West Coast Silicon Valley lifestyle, whether it happens to be physically in Silicon Valley or replicated in the Pacific Northwest or New York City, of, you know, oh, you can work 3 days a week from home, and, you know, when you go in, there are free lunches, and there's a massage table, and there's, you know, this benefit and that benefit. It's created a set of expectations of, you know, you walking into an office environment, and there's a pinball machine in the office that is very hard for those of us who don't work in those kind of campus environments to replicate.
Well, you have your finger right on the pulse of one of the best, you know, universities to get more people into STEM. I mean, maybe is there something you can do to make it easier to get in, cheaper? What can you do, Andy, right?
So it's true. The problem with the University at Carnegie Mellon is that we don't scale well. So I graduate about 30 full-time cybersecurity students and 30 part-time cybersecurity students a year. And let's say there's 30 schools that might do the same at our level. That's just such a drop in the bucket. That doesn't meet sort of one day's demand in that field. So I think we do have to, whether it's with technology-enabled learning or upskilling the workforce that we have to get them there. So, for example, we're working with UPMC, which is a major hospital provider in Pennsylvania, at taking their analysts and upskilling them to be data scientists. And they find that it's a lot easier to take existing talent and give them skills than it is to attract talent away from some of these high-tech firms.
And I think that's one of the things we're seeing in the federal government as well, where CIOs are trying to send people to get new training. You know, listen, we don't need someone to be a systems administrator. That's in the cloud now, but you have some skills that we can move you into, you know, agile development or something else. So I think we're starting to see that as well. So we've talked a lot about your program and your study, and we talked about the costs and the courses. What should federal employees, contractors really need to know before they decide, hey, this Carnegie Mellon CIO certificate program is for me? What should they know?
So I think the certificate program is a wonderful way to get up to speed on current trends in technology and in organizational behavior, to learn from your peers and to do so in a friendly environment. To go the next step, however, requires you to get into a master's program. And we have a wonderful program, Master of Science in Information Technology, which we've provided in distance mode for the last 15 years. And that is a commitment, because whether you do it at Carnegie Mellon or any other university, it's a matter of balancing a career and a personal life with academics. And doing that, and the idea of sort of hitting the books again, even though the books may be virtual, is something that you need to view yourself as a lifelong learner and be able to make that commitment to make that balance between life, career, and academics.
One last thing before I let you go. You mentioned earlier in the discussion of that you guys used to have to follow a more specific set of requirements when you're with the CIO University program that was run by the federal government, GSA specifically. You said, but that GSA discontinued the program. Can you talk a little bit about what happened and what's that mean for you guys?
It was really interesting because we and George Washington and Syracuse and University of Maryland and a couple of other schools had a program that didn't put any sort of pressure or tax on the GSA. They basically just had to bless it and provide a certificate at the end, and it was going successfully at Carnegie Mellon University and at these other universities. So we were all surprised when it ended because it wasn't a financial burden on the government. Interestingly enough, though, all of the universities found that even without the government blessing, there's enough interest with federal workers who are just so engaged in their field and want to stay current with trends and best practices that we've all separately continued with our programs and have been doing it without the GSA CIO certificate.
All right, well, it's good news that they are still going on because I know it's a good program. I've heard lots about it. We are unfortunately out of time. I'd like to thank our guest today, Andy Wasser, the Associate Dean in Carnegie Mellon University's Hines College School of Information Systems and Management, and, of course, the Executive Director of the CIO Institute. Andy, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you've been listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Ask the Chief Information Officer. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, Ask the CIO, Thursday mornings at 10:30, only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Hi, I'm Jared Serbu, the host of Federal News Radio's On DoD. Join me each week for a close-up view of the Defense Department from the management perspective. We examine the department from every angle with interviews with top brass and industry experts. It's reliable information from the people in the know. That's On DoD, every Wednesday at 11 o'clock and 2 o'clock Eastern on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, or download it anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search On DoD.